welcome to the Astro All-Stars podcast. I'm your host, Vanessa Montgomery, pro astrologer and author of Star Power and Cosmic Power. This podcast is for you if you're an astro-curious modern mystic and ready to free your mind, own your power, and create your world. Let's go! Hey, Starling, thanks for joining me for another episode of the Astro All-Stars podcast. I'm your host, Vanessa Montgomery. And today, my special guest is Uber Libran Brian Clark, spilling the cosmic tea on all things Libra with pro tips and lived insights. With natal placements of the Sun, Neptune, Mercury, and the Moon, blessed by this Venusian sign and almost 50 years of astrology behind him, who better to chat Libra with? One of the leading lights of the astrology community here in Australia, Brian, along with Glynis Lawton, ran the Astrosynthesis School of Astrology from the Chiron Centre in Melbourne, which is where I began my formal studies in astrology. Here's a quote from Brian: "Astrology and archetypes never change. It's the social context that changes. And the archetypal stream source isn't binary, it's unity. It's been caught in a cultural dynamic." So Brian calls us to honour the archetypal streams that flow underneath, and I second that motion. So Brian has his master's and bachelor with honours in classics and archaeology from the University of Melbourne, and for 20 years he conducted tours to the ancient sacred sites through Odyssey tours to ancient Greece. He has taught astrology for the past 40 years and lectured in Asia, Australia, Europe and North America. Brian began his study of astrology in 1972, has served as national president for the Fraternity of Canadian Astrologers and the Federation of Australian Astrologers, as well as the chairman of the Association of Professional Astrologers. He has twice received awards from the FCA, received the Education Award from the Federation of Australian Astrologers, and been nominated four times for an International Regulus Award and twice for the Charles Harvey Award from the Astrological Association of Great Britain. So we're in good hands. Today we cover, among other things, Libra's place between Virgo and Scorpio, the Pluto in Libra Generation X, Neptune in Libra Generation, subjective participation, allowing the symbols to speak, imagination, underlying astro techniques, separating cultural overlay from underlying archetypes, myth and ancient Greece, of course, astrologers as seers, participation, Chiron, and so much more. Head to Brian's website, astrosynthesis.com.au, that's astrosynthesis, astrosynthesis.com.au, to find more Brian. You'll find, as I said, his talks, courses, books, and more there. Sign up for his newsletter so you can keep abreast of any new courses coming up. And hang about to the end of this interview because I'm going to read you a couple of things from his book on relationships and astrology, From the Moment We Met, The Astrology of Adult Relationships. It covers everything. There's synastry, there's lots of stuff. It's great for beginners and intermediate as well. He's got a beautiful style, and we're going to look at the seventh house and also Venus. Enjoy our interview till then. Welcome back to the Astro All-Stars podcast. I have with me a very special guest talking all things Libra today, Brian Clark, astrologer extraordinaire and one of my first teachers, actually. What's it called? The Wikipedia.
Astro.com.
Astro.com has it. So look up Brian Clark there. But you have a few other things too, the Neptune near your moon, which I think that's just amplified the Libran moon charm and poetic as well. The other thing is I always found you very poetic and soulful with the astrology, which is why I thought it would also be interesting to have you on to talk about that approach. But we'll get to that. Let's talk Libra first. What can you share with us about Libra and being a Venus-ruled person?
Well, what can we say about Libra? First of all, what's so interesting, my interest in mythology, of course, and Libra is the last sign that really, really got named. It's the only inanimate object or sign, let's say, of the zodiac. All the rest are animals and humans. And so it was the Romans that sort of finally put the scales into the zodiac. The Babylonians had thought about that. But the interesting thing about Libra is that was known as the claws of the scorpion, Cheli, before it became the scales. And I think that's a great way to describe Libra. You know, it looks good on the surface, but underneath there's these claws. And I guess the other thing too is it sort of sits between Virgo and Scorpio. And that's pretty difficult placement because, I mean, in Virgo, I guess we learn about that sense of you know, the sanctity and the sovereignty of oneself. And then all of a sudden, how do we move with that towards, you know, a much more intimate, shared resourceful union. So I think Libra's kind of, it wants to have the choices available. And certainly, you know, by making a choice, one sort of, you know, corners or narrows down what other choices in life. So I think it's not so much about not being able to make a decision. It's like, what choices do we want? Because we know what we want. Certainly Libras do know what they want, but they don't want to identify it. They want someone else to do it for them.
And like, to me, it just speaks of the axis, you know, opposite Aries, which is so incredibly decisive and, you know, acting before it thinks. And Libra's like, hey, on. But I guess it does pass the buck to the Aries, and the Aries will have to wear it.
The Aries is the I and the Libra is the you, you know, like, so Aries says, this is what I want. And Libra says, this is what you want. But really is what they want to. I think I've always thought Libras are just, you know, well-disguised Aryans, to tell you the truth. They're just more polite Aryans.
Yes.
You know, I think they're much more polite Aryans.
Yeah, I'll agree with that. The Libran friends that I have, they do get their way. They just go about it that you don't even realize that, hence the charm, you know.
Yeah, you don't realize it. Yeah. Before they enter the room, and all of a sudden they create a storm, and then they, of course, make sure that the storm is sort of quelled by the time they leave, and everybody thinks, "Oh my goodness, they're really negotiators and compromisers and good diplomats," and that's all true. But they also know how to create a storm. That's for sure.
Yeah, right. Well, you have to be pretty tough across from Aries, and that's a great point. Thinking about the positioning between Virgo and Scorpio, you know, that's not a walk in the park.
No, it's not a walk in the park. I mean, you know, it is. These are very two powerful, you know, archetypal forces that, you know, that pull oftentimes in opposite directions. And there's Libra in the middle of them, you know, as always. Yes. Let's not forget too, it's cardinal air. So it likes to get going. It likes to start things, but not necessarily likes to end things. and it likes to get things going, but once it gets things going, what's next? Let's try something new. So there's a cardinality very much to Libra that's really important too. It has a love of beauty. There's no doubt about the Venus part of that. It loves beauty, and it loves that sense of symmetry and sense of poetry. You know, T.S. Eliot, one of my favorite poets, you know, he's got a stellium in Libra.
Right.
His ascendant is 25 Libra, and this is a time birth, and Venus is right on there at 24 degrees of Libra. So he's a sun in the 12th house of Venus on the ascendant. And there's T.S. Eliot, who wrote this enormously rich, deep poetry, which of course everyone quotes in famous lines like the end is the beginning and all this kind of stuff. But he's a good example of that Libran stellium.
Yes, yeah, that's a good point, because people, and I often think of a poet being Pisces or Neptunian, but it's definitely comes through with the Libras, and I guess that's that artistic and airy quality.
I think it's the ability to craft a word, you know, to craft a thought, to have a resonance with the word, because it's air. So it moves on from the Gemini, you know, it's that second air sign. So it's moved on from the Geminian love of words to the kind of crafting of words, I think. You know, but my astro twin born 10 minutes after me, how come I didn't get all of that? But that's Bruce Springsteen. Now, there's another good poet, isn't he? He's another good writer and another good poet. But he speaks to the times.
Yes.
So he's got a stellium in Libra as well.
And I never would have guessed that. I thought that was interesting when you said that in your email, Bruce Springsteen, because, yeah, I guess he seems very like, the working class man. And, you know, I wouldn't have thought Libra. But, yeah, you're right, of course. And any songwriter's got to have that skill with words as well.
I guess with Springsteen, it's also too, like me, we got the very strong Neptune. You know, so the very strong Neptunian quality, Neptune Mercury conjunction,
yes,
which is part of that too,
absolutely.
And so you know, the kind of sense of chameleon kind of quality to Springsteen. You know, working class man, so he can identify with others, and everyone can get out of him. So that's a sense of being able to merge into others. But you know, but Libra is other oriented. It is very much other orientated. So that's really important about that particular sign. It's able to look outside self to see other. And so, you know, it is a sign, if we just think about Aries to Libra, we just do that natural wheel, everything's under the horizon, and now Libra starts to rise up above it, isn't it?
Yeah.
And of course, we have the sun in Libra, you know, and that we have that kind of, the glyph of Libra is like the sun setting, isn't it? Like,
yeah,
there it is. There's a sun setting on the horizon. So there's a setting about Libra, I think, that's very important, which is the ability to sort of set in oneself so that one can see other.
Yeah, I guess it dims the light on oneself so that other light can be seen. I think it's interesting, you being a Libra stellium and the partnership idea, and you have run your business all these years with your partner, Glynis. Can you tell me a little bit about when you met? I know there's a boat involved and an astrology conference. Can you just share that quickly?
There is. Well, we met in 1983 in the harbor of New York. And there was a conference on a cruise ship, which was run by the Institute of Astrology and Metaphysics in New York. And I was invited to be a speaker on that. And Glynis happened to be one of the participants on that cruise, and that's where we first met. Yeah, so we met in the harbor of New York, and the boat set sail for the Bahamas through the Bermuda Triangle.
Oh my gosh!
So that was a long time ago.
Yeah, and what a great romantic story for the Libran as well. I think of you as a little bit Captain Stubing and the Love Boat, and that song comes to my mind a lot. So it's funny that you did meet on that. So for Libra, that, you know, I've themed songs for a lot of things, and in my mind I do correlate the theme song from the show The Love Boat with Libra. And then you guys did meet on there, and at the last astrology conference in Melbourne, because of course Brian and Glynis have run those for many years, you dressed up as a captain. I'm like, oh my god, my vision is coming true.
That's right, we did dress up as a captain, right, but not of a ship. interesting point. It's a kind of a sense, but romance is always there for Libra. But it wasn't romance at the beginning. Libra takes a time, you know. It does have its time, and it has its distance. It's cardinal, so it wants to, you know, go, but it still also stands back. I think it's cardinal. It wants to start things once it gets going, but you know, sometimes doesn't know how to involve itself, so it stands a little bit back.
Interesting.
Or maybe I'm just speaking for myself.
But that would make sense though, because if it's opposite Aries, and Aries is the one that like gets things going, Libra's just there being attractive and starting the conversation. But I remember in one of our classes, like I did gain a lot of insight about air and Libra, particularly from you. And one of the things you were saying is that, you know, the air signs in Libra, you know, they need the space to circulate in between. So unlike water, they don't look to merge. They do look to be able to come in and separate. There's got to be that space.
Oh, yeah. If air doesn't have that space, yeah, space is so important. If it doesn't, it can't breathe. Give me space. And so the more space it gets, of course, the more it's able to expand its feeling life. And then, of course, they start missing. Then the other comes closer. But there's always a panic when they get too close. yeah, there needs to be individuality in space. Again, I guess we can go back to the sense of, you know, Virgo underpinning Libra, which is really the sense of the psychic task of being separate so that one can enter into relationship.
Yes.
Yeah, the psychic task, you know, the sense of being separate as an entity. And then, of course, Scorpio follows, which is one that wants to merge. Yeah. But you have to, so that's where I think Libra is fairly in the middle of those two.
Yeah.
But yeah, air needs space, Vanessa, there's no doubt about it. So and you would know.
I've got plenty of air and plenty of fire. So I need a lot of space.
As soon as they give you space, you shoot through. You're out of it.
Yeah. I shoot through. I don't know. I mean, I'm a Sagittarius, but I've got a bulk of planets in the seventh and the eighth, which is an interesting point about houses. You know, you've got the sign, and then I feel like the houses that are really important in your chart, it makes you like an honorary whatever that is. It definitely brings that flavor in. So I'm not Libran, but I've got, Pluto and Uranus in Libra. And then I've got all these placements in the seventh and the eighth. So there's definitely tip the scales too close. No, come back. No, there's a little bit of that, but independence definitely overrides everything because of all the Sag and Moon in Aries. The Pluto generation. So Pluto in Scorpio is the millennials.
Yep.
Of course, you're part of the Pluto and Leo gang that really has held astrology, you know, and set it up and set all the conferences up and got everything going and, you know, still in there sort of quite strongly as well. The millennials have then come in and, you know, they love the astrology. They're all over it. That Pluto and Scorpio, I think, loves that metaphysical side of things. And here we are with astrology and crystals and tarot. But the Pluto in Virgo and Pluto in Libra, it seems to have sort of jumped over us. Do you think that's because we're like more quiet signs? do you think the Pluto in Libra has crew, Generation X, the younger version of it, has brought that Libra potential through for society? Or do you think we're still working on it?
Well, the Pluto in Libra generation right now are really at that critical time of life, aren't they? They're you know, 40s, pushing into 50. You
pushing
know,
the car on return.
Pushing the car on return. Yeah. So they're midlifers, you know, they're midlifers right now. And my experience of that generation, well, first of all, you know, having a stellium in Libra and then having Pluto go through that stellium, you know, one remembers that really well. And the times that the Pluto and Libra generation were born, really significant times in terms of how relationship began to be restated. You know, there was the divorce, divorce rates soared, there were, you know, gay liberation, feminine, female liberation, there's all kinds of stuff that began to reshape. And I think probably people of that generation still don't quite appreciate how very, very strict one's upbringing was in terms of relationship, you know, in those 50s and 60s times. But what I've noticed as far as astrology is concerned with the Pluto and Libra generation, because I have a lot of astrologers and therapists sometimes get in touch with me and ask if we can do some tutorials or supervision. And what I noticed in that most of them are Pluto and Libra, but they also have this very strong urge to look at, you know, bring back the mythology, bring back more of the psychology, you know, so it they feel like they're holding a little bit of that imaginative part of astrology. That's been my feeling. So that I find that they're the Pluto and Libra is they're adding to the depth of the experience that one has with understanding the imagination. Virgo generation did also add, there's a lot of them started to reconstruct the structures of astrology, you know, bring it more onto the web and things like that. I think probably the younger generations, as you're saying, Pluto and Scorpio, even now Pluto and Sag generations, have grown up with all that technology, so they know what to do, you know. But yeah, no, I do think the Pluto generation, Pluto and Libra generation, is just right at that threshold where they're the ones that are actually going to be, they're the ones on stage. Yeah, they're the ones out there. They're the ones on stage. They're the ones that now have enough experience. I'm going to pull the age card right now and be very parental and very old and say the Pluto and Scorpio and the Pluto and Sag generation perhaps don't have enough experience yet. Yeah, lots of ideas, lots of feeling, lots of depth, but maybe not the experience. But the Pluto in Libra generation now have the experience. And they're reaching that kind of age, I think, where they can feel that experience. They can feel that they're getting old enough to know what they would like to speak about and differentiate. Mm. So I don't know if that's made sense, but I feel it's a very powerful generation. So many changes. Yeah.
It does make sense to me. And it's, yeah, you can, you know, I just think about how I can see the other generation. So it's interesting to hear your view of, yeah, my generation. And also, of course, I do think about that idea of when you have a stellium in one sign, when that generation comes through. So I have so much in Sagittarius. I'm really interested in seeing what happens with this Pluto in Sagittarius Gen Z generation. Yeah. Like, will I really relate to them? Like, did you really relate to the Pluto in Libra ones, or did they sort of, do they bring things up in you because of the Pluto?
Yeah, well, absolutely. Yeah, I relate to them because they don't know whether they would challenge, you know, because there is now the age gap. So you're never going to see me as an equal in any way, but as we're from a whole different age gap. Yeah, we can converse and we can share what we love and we can do all of that. But yeah, they challenge you. They challenge you to be able to articulate what's important. That's what they seem to want. Well, they know that you might have something to offer, so they challenge ways of trying to get that out of you.
Yeah, that's interesting.
The early ones in the generation, because my son's right at Zero Libra, so the earlier ones, really challenge that. And then the later ones of that generation, because then I have the stellium later degrees, born two-thirds of the way through that generation, challenge more the feeling life and ways of articulating that. So yeah, they do challenge, but in a respectful way because of the age difference. So what you're saying with your Sag planet, the Pluto in Sagittarius generation will do that as well. Of course, because Pluto started moving faster, there's not going to be so much of an age gap as me with the others, but it'll still be the same thing, I think.
Interesting point. And yeah, to remember, one, it depends where they're born as well, of course, depending on where your planets are, early, late, mid, true. Yeah. Yes. Yeah. Well, I'm liking what I'm seeing so far with the Pluto and Sag crew.
Yeah. Well, because I'm not on Facebook and TikTok, I have enough association with that because of grandkids and so on. But because I'm not on all that, I don't quite know that generation in terms of the whole generation.
I feel like I relate to them so far. But back to Libra, when did you start teaching?
Oh, teaching astrology?
Yeah.
Yeah, well, I had a class. My first class I ever had was in my home when I lived in Ottawa. So that was probably 1977 or 78. And that was a class with a few people. And so I had studied already for about 5 years on my own by then. But and in those days, of course, we didn't have all the technological gadgets to connect. People actually came to other people's homes and so on. And that's how we started. And then I started being asked to teach at metaphysical or other organizations, and also in some of the astrology conventions in the States. So then that's how I started.
Yeah, that's a lot of experience, isn't it? Because it's so observational, the astrology. I just wanted to put that into context for people listening, because some people have like 6 months and they're already like out there.
Yeah, well, you're right. It's so observational. And being in the classes, Vanessa, you'd understand how much you learn, because everybody,
absolutely.
You, we're just talking about one, let's say we do the class of the air signs. And then of course, all the Geminis and Libras and Aquarians will tell you their stories. And all their stories add to this depth and richness of experience. And so over the years, not just with my own personal clients, but with students, I've had the grace of having learned from them so much, you know. Absolutely.
And they do say that next level in learning is teaching.
Yeah. And sometimes we often teach what we need to know, you know. We teach, as they say, we keep teaching. But one of the great things about teaching, why I still do love it, is I love the research, you know. So the researching of something. So really beginning to research in depth.
Yeah. Yes. And you've written so many books, and you've been, like, I guess all that air, of course, you've written a lot, you know, and they're beautiful. And I see you've self-published. I didn't realize. I've got the relationship from the moment we met, the Astrology of Adult Relationships here. Thank you so much. And I see you've self-published it, and it's beautiful. Like, yeah, good job. And there's so much in it. I'm wondering, you know, this has got to be an opus for Libra Stellium, a book on relationships.
Well, writing came later in my life because during our teaching and our classes at the Chiron Center, as you know, we were always so busy. I mean, we were busy with teaching, with classes, with consulting, with life, busy with life. And so I, as you know, we made a lot of booklets for the classes. And out of those booklets, I started putting them all together. And so the booklets that we were written on the seventh house and the eighth house and any on synastry and all that sort of coalesced into that particular book. The irony was I did have my first book called The Sibling Constellation published by Penguin Arcana, but I've never had much luck with publishers. Oh. They didn't want to. So what happened was a publisher in Taiwan got in touch with me, and they wanted to have all my little booklets put into books, you know, would I write this? So I thought, oh, why not? So I wrote these books for the Taiwanese market, and they were all translated into Taiwanese. And so I had this manuscript. I thought, well, why not? And Frank Clifford, thank goodness, helped me. Frank said, oh, I can do that for you. I said, oh, Brian, these are great. I'll do this for you. So he's enormously helpful. So kind. Another Pluto and Libra, you see.
Yes, help doing things together. Yes.
doing things, but also being very honoring of that. Yeah, doing things together. So there, he was very, very helpful in having these books published. And this one on relationships, it was always my fascination, part of astrology for me, when you could use two people's charts to then put them together and see the alchemy of everything and how I relate to you. And the moment you said, well, you're a Sag, and I'm thinking to myself, I wonder what degree her Sagittarian sun is, because my descendant is, you know, so that's how I always thought.
Yes, of course, right.
When you meet somebody. So what degree is your sun?
It's at five Sag.
Five Sag, okay. So it's in my sixth Sag. And what other planets do you have in Sag?
I've got Neptune at 2 degrees Sagittarius. Okay, I've got Jupiter at, I think it's 14 degrees Sagittarius.
Yeah.
Mercury at 26 and Venus at 28. So okay. At the other end.
Okay, so yeah, so your Jupiter. Well, all that stellium falls across the descendant, but Jupiter's right there. So Jupiter's on it. So when so part of that is always in my mind. Not that when I meet people, I think, well, what are they, or where do they fit in my chart? But once you start talking to someone, and as we're doing, one wonders. Yeah.
Yeah, I totally can relate to that. Yes, I can. Yeah. After all these years, I can hear people speak their archetypal bits and pieces. Yeah. I like to look at, how am I affecting this person, or where are they on my chart? I've got all the seventh and eighth. So even though I'm a Sag, a moon in selfish Aries, I'm still going to be super interested socially. So, yeah, and it's another, that's another thing too that's worth saying, and what I like to hear from astrologers that can speak the language and have had that observation, how they see things, because you are still going to come through with that bias towards a Libran lens, you know. And if I know where your planets are and where they're coming from, I can learn about, I can hear and learn about how you're seeing things, and that opens up things for me to see that I wouldn't normally. Like, I always find it fascinating, people with really strong first houses, I can hear it. I can tell they're coming from the other side of that horoscope. And isn't that interesting? And they won't be so open to my side, but of course they won't. They're not meant to. So yeah, it's fascinating learning from the other person and hearing. Yeah. Hearing,
well, that's how we really, aspects. I think that's where we do really learn astrology, is on the ground. I mean, yes, we learn it all through the books, but once you get in the consulting room, you learn it on the ground. And that's what you're saying. And I think that's absolutely true. You know, you hear the story and you're looking at the chart when you're with a client, you know, you're talking about that and you hear the story and you hear the chart, at least I do. It's Me like too. It starts to sing.
Yes.
It starts to speak, the symbols speak. And I'm really aware that over time, really what happened, why astrology works, is because of some subjective, you know, participation allows the symbols to speak in a way.
Yes.
And you can hear that through the chart. And so you use the word like you can see. You know, you can see. And so that's what we do as astrologers. We see through things. Mm. And that's, in the ancient days, we used to be called seers, not because we knew things, but we could see through things, you know.
So, yeah.
And the symbols help us see through that. It happens in the moment. I don't think we start out thinking, I'm going to see this or see that. It happens in the moment that we're speaking. It arises.
Seeing that you have that Neptune on your moon as well, I have Neptune on my sun, and I wonder, is that a little bit of that? Because I totally relate to you talking about astrology in this way and that soulfulness and it being alive in the moment. Like, it is about, of course, for anyone with a strong seventh house or Libra, of course, it's about coming together and things happening in that union, because that's where the magic happens a lot of the time for me too. It's extremely, extremely intuitive. And, you know, if I think of an archetype, I'll immediately think of, oh, this person or that story, and I'll look it up and there it all is, you know. And I wonder if that's like that for everyone. But you have a whole book on this about, you know, just looking into the symbolism and soul of astrology, which is on my reading list for once I finish what I'm working on at the moment, because I don't hear a lot of people talk about astrology like you do. Like, I think there's a reason I found you guys and learnt with you, and that's probably one of the reasons for me. And that nice contrast with Glynis's style as well really helped set everything. Obviously, everyone's stories in the class was just, it just cemented things, was fantastic. But that soulfulness, and I think what I've noticed now is millennials want certainty. And this, it's an illusion. Like, there's no certainty. It is an illusion. Like, you know, if you're going to get metaphysical, the fact is things are alive in the moment, you know, and we come back to that approach that you talk about.
I think what you said is very apropos, that, you know, your Neptune sun conjunction, my Neptune moon, it is. And over time, I guess I came to appreciate that not everyone is going to see it this way. Mm. And it's interesting you mentioned Glynis's approach, because hers is much different. It's probably much more, it's much more defined or practical than mine.
She's like more Saturnine, and you're Saturn. Like more That's Neptunian. Right. Yeah.
So her, I was going to say Saturn, but so let's go to the Neptune archetype, and that you can understand that. So yeah, it took me, I often felt like maybe I wasn't a real astrologer, because what would happen, I would use astrology, but then something else would happen. I would see other things or feel other things. Like you knew a myth. A myth would talk to me, or in that moment or whatever. So, but I came to realize, yes, that's the way that I worked. And I would like to encourage and support anybody who kind of feels that way, but not everybody will.
Yeah.
It's the same with me. I mean, I don't get that excited by all the techniques, you know, like
yeah,
I get excited by I get excited by the imagination that underlies a technique, which is very interesting because that's always been used as astrologers, even though I didn't have names for it. So with all the traditional, revival and all the new things that are coming out, I think, oh, I've already had felt that in a certain way. I just didn't have a name for it. So I get excited by not the technique telling me that this means that, but because the technique has a rich history to me. You know, astrology has always been acausal. It's never been causal to me. It's not been a cause effect. It's happened outside of that realm. And when it has, it's, as you said, you use the word magic, it's magical.
Yeah, I think so.
I think it's even sometimes more than intuitive. It is intuitive, there's no doubt about that, but it's even sometimes more than intuitive because it takes us over. And so because when you're highly Neptunian, there's a medial, you know, an archetype of the Pythia or the seer or the, you know, the oracle, that's all part of that. So
yes,
it can take us over. You're like a vessel for it.
Yes.
Yeah.
And speaking of that, let's go to the myths and that time where these things, oracles, were just part of society and it was understood and it wove in quite nicely, ancient Greece and back in those times. You have got did you get a bachelor or a master's? Was it in, Greek mythology?
It was a master's in classics and archaeology.
Yep.
I went back quite later in my life to do the classics because I was always interested in. So I wanted to shape what I already knew and shape that more into form, I guess. But I'll tell you an interesting thing that happened, just sprung to mind, Vanessa. When in my first class in classics and archaeology, we were doing just classical mythology. I was at the Chiron Center. We called it the Chiron Center. We've been there forever. And this is about 6 years after the Chiron Center started. Chiron was always very important to me. And so in the first class, in the tutorial class, the professor asked us what was of interest. And I said, well, what was of interest to me is to learn out some names properly. And he said, oh, Brian, that's a very good question. And he jumped up out of his chair and he said, take the word Chiron. And he put Chiron on the board and he pronounced Chiron. And I sat there thinking, of all the mythological gods and goddesses he could choose, he chose Chiron. Yeah? So that's how it works. I thought to myself, it works this way. So the myths were always highly, highly important to me because they spoke to me in ways and images. And so what I learned in my classics was, you know, the sources from whence they came, the time frames, the kind of, you know, movement of myth and how myth infuses us and all kinds of things. And that prompted me to then start taking tours.
Did you lead tours in Greece? Or
yeah.
Yes.
I did.
You do any of those with Demetra George?
I did. Demetra and I have done a few. Demetra George, Melanie Reinhardt, and I did one in 1997, the three of us. We had 39 people. That was amazing. And then Demetra asked me to do one with her for the 25th anniversary of her book, Asteroid Goddesses. So we did one then. And then I did another one with her students, probably 2005, I think. But yeah, in all, I've done about 18 tours.
Oh, wow.
Generally with a dear friend who's a psychotherapist and dream therapist, and so we would have dream groups as we go, and every itinerary was different. I would research where we'd go, and we'd go to a lot of sanctuaries that were well known.
I must say, I don't have a lot of regrets in life, but I wish I went on one of those with you guys.
They were quite amazing. They were. You just, you know, because when you stepped on the portal or through the portal of those very sacred places where the Eleusinian mysteries would have been reenacted, or as you mentioned, the oracular sites, like going to Delphi or any of these oracular sites, you learn that there was also healing sites very nearby. So we would also visit the healing sites. And it's very, very special.
So did you have any mystical experiences or downloads, or do you feel like it really fleshed out your understanding of the myths even more, so that they you recognize them even clearer when you were hearing someone speak or doing a consultation and things like that, or able to channel them in your lectures?
I think for me, what they did is help me place them, you know, because I could see how they were placed and on the landscape. So what happened was, you know, I started to see the landscape and how that was built and how the myths, you know, were really all part of that. Once you're inside a myth, it does speak to you. And, you know, like sometimes we prepare, like going to Eleusis, I always get some of the women on the tours to read the Homeric hymn to Demeter. And so, because this is a woman's story. And of course, then the next day there'd be all these dreams of mothers and daughters. And,
oh my gosh.
And we share those dreams. And so we were in a process always. It's, you know, for 2 weeks. And there'd be dreams, you know. And one of my most favorite sanctuaries is the sanctuary to Artemis called Breron, which is perhaps about 40 kilometers south of Athens. And this is where young girls, you know, around the ages of 8 to 10 would be initiated into what they called the bear, you know, because the bear was a kind of icon of Artemis, and they'd be initiated into their own girlhood. And so there was all kinds of fantastic places we visit. And the last time we visited there, I had many women come up to me after and say, oh, I saw young girls dancing over near the, so there's always, and I'm remembering also in the Temple of Apollo, how people came up to me after and said they saw their brother or they saw their father or they, you know, and they were dead, but they saw images. So these sacred places hold this spiritual life, and not just the spiritual life, the kind of spiritual life that can bleed through to the temporal.
That's amazing. And could you really feel the different energy of the different ones when you went in? Was that palpable?
Well, what you could notice is on the well-trodden sites, like the Parthenon, for instance, there's not a lot of feeling there. And even if you go to Epidavros, which was Asclepian, the Asclepian healing site, everybody visits the incredible theater. Not a lot of feeling in it. Lots of fun. But I find places to go to the back where none of the people would go, no visitors would go, and then the feeling was there. So on the well-trodden sanctuaries that most people go to, a lot of feelings just been kind of, you know,
yeah, interesting.
But so you have to go visit those ones in the countryside. Or, you know.
Yeah, that's interesting. And the synchronicity happens.
Yeah.
I have like a love-hate relationship with Greece because of the way they were with women, but I do recognize that there's amazing things that they brought in, and one of my favorite things is that idea of having that archetypal energy embodied in a deity and then having a special place and temple for that and going to it. And I try to bring that through my work, like if, you know, say Pluto's coming through your chart, you know, it's tough, but what does it want? What, you know, the house that it's in, what does it want from you? Freaking give it to it, or it's going to like slam you until you do. Like it does help to conceptualize things, to externalize it that way.
I'm interested in your comment, Vanessa, about your love-hate relationship because of the way the Greeks treated the women. I think I understand it, but I think I do. But can you articulate that a bit more for me?
I guess because looking back, well, first of all, you know, I'd hear all these myths and they seem quite rapey and just, you know, a bit rough for a lot of things that happened to women in myths. So I looked more into the society, and it just looks like at the time, you know, Sparta had its own thing going on, and looking at the relationships there and women's place in society. Over at Crete, you know, it was pretty happening for women. It seemed much more equal. And then ancient Greece, you know, it's been compared to, like, there's a show that's fairly new called The Ascent of Woman, and they do go through Greece, and what they say about ancient Greece is the women's experience at that time was pretty comparable to the worst point of what women live under in the Taliban. You know, they were property. It wasn't good. There were slaves. There were also slaves there, like
quite a lot of hierarchy.
But women were pretty much property.
Interesting, isn't it? Because when you scrape away the kind of cultural overlay, you scrape away the cultural overlay and the political overlay, right down to the heart of the kind of archetypal and the deities. You know, you have these incredible, images. Let's just take the most well-known ones of Persephone, you know, that archetypal journey that of separation from mother and, you know, then initiation to the underworld. And then this incredible sense of sovereignty and the founding of the Eleusinian mysteries. Now, you're right that in the context of the culture and everything like that, it is abysmal as far as women were treated. But, you know, I think women get a lot of sustenance by seeing those women of myth who are really, really powerful and potent.
It's very important.
But you know, what you see clearly, I guess, in the Greek myth is the change of times. You know, when we do move from a more matrilineal, you know, to patrilineal.
Yeah.
And that is in us all. You know, it's like the movement from night to day. It's a movement in some way. And it's hard to talk about these things sometimes without getting that political, social, cultural overlay onto it. And then I lose myself because I think, I like you, I can't bear it. It's unbelievable. It's full on, and it's still going on.
We're living in the shadow of it. And so I get really I find it hard to even talk too much about because I get really angry. It's very threatening to me, but I'm still able to say I love some amazing things about that Greek culture, and particularly the ones that I mentioned. I think that is absolutely magical, and I love the magic in there. But this side, so I looked back, where did those myths come from that we use so much in astrology, those archetypes, those embodiments, how they're spoken about. And last year particularly, I did a lot of historical looking, trying to look up, where did they come from? How did that slowly change? What were the societies underneath that? And I found it really interesting, and it's helped because I want to keep changing that now. You know, I've got this thing about, you know, people are like Mars is masculine or the sun is the king. And I'm just like, we all have a sun, we all have a Mars, and this has to change. But why is it like it is already? And I need to understand it so I can help be that change and help use language that's different and open it up for everybody, which is what I've put into my books. And I see that you refer to those things in your books too. I noticed in this one, you'll say, you'll sort of open it up to different genders as well. Because I just say to people, mix it up. Have it neutral. Find new words to say what you're trying to say.
Well, you're speaking now about the Pluto and Libra generation that is redefining. So there's a good example, I think.
That's yes.
If we can strip away, you're right. You know, when a sun, everyone's got a sun. So the sun, when we start applying gender and all of this kind of stuff to it, we get lost. You know, we've lost in astrology the archetypal stream that flows underneath every horoscope. We've lost that. So that's where I do see your generation, Pluto and Libra, bringing that back. Now, but we get caught in trying to say, we've got to, take this out or do this or change it, because we're getting caught in cultural... get caught in the cultural dynamic. I think we need to return to the archetypal source all the time, to the pure stream underneath, which isn't binary. It's one. It's oneness. You know. So it's so
sounding
that's
very Neptunian all of a sudden.
You'll be like, not making sense.
No, you are making sense. I can just hear the Neptune, the oneness.
Well, I think to me that's it. So, but you see, what happens is astrology never changes, archetypes never change. It's the social context that's changing.
Absolutely.
And so the social context and all of that. And so we need to bring it. So your generation does need to bring it to this new social context. Yeah. So you do need to make it more gender inclusive. You do need to make it more less gender divisive or less anything divisive.
Yeah, while maintaining what those archetypes are meant to represent. Well, yeah, absolutely. Yeah, I think it's fascinating. It's a good challenge. I like the challenge of that.
Well, you're doing it. See, that's, I think, it's your time. See, that's where that's what I would say, Blue Liberal Generation. It's your time in astrology. I've had my time. I'm here to help, but I don't necessarily need to be out there anymore. It's your time, and there's a lot to come through. But I think I would like your generation to, and all generations in astrology to honor the archetypal force and streams that flow underneath and influence and each of those archetypes in the horoscope.
Yeah, I'm quite happy to do that. I think that's what it's really built from and made with, and that's what I think we can pick up from that ancient Greece way of having those temples and things like that. Like, I think we've lost touch with how to even do that these days in a lot of ways, so how to bring that back. On that note, I must ask, do you, like, you know, a lot of people like to focus on Pluto or Chiron, but it's like energy goes where the mind flows, right? Do you sometimes just think, I'm just going to focus on Venus and Jupiter for a while and have that energy come into my life?
I don't know if I could. I don't know how to answer that. You know, there's a pantheon, isn't there? It's not just one god. There's a pantheon of them. And if I pay too much attention to Aphrodite or to Venus, something's going to happen. You know?
Yes, right.
You know what I mean? So it's like
the jealous gods.
Yeah, all of a sudden, boom. Yeah. I don't know how to answer that. Do you do that?
I think about doing that because I'm having my Chiron return at the moment, right? And I've got Chiron conjunct my moon natally, right? The same degree. And so I was like, I better get onto this because Chiron's coming. As soon as I decided that every single client has like some major Chironic transit or natal situation, as soon as I asked for it, it happened. And I'm like, man, I should be focusing on Jupiter or Venus.
May I turn it around a bit?
Yes.
And say, it's not that you asked for that. It's like you're participating in it. This is the astrology of you're participating, and the clients come to us at those times because we can read that. So it's not really, again, a causal thing or a kind of even a mind thing. Or it's that archetype is embracing you. Your chart tells you that. Yeah, Chiron moon. Well, there's so many stories there. But as you know, the Chiron was very special to me because it filled in something that I couldn't see in any other ways in the horoscope. So it has always spoken to me. It's been very powerful.
Yeah. And, so can you tell me a bit more about that? It's in your sixth house. Oh, it's conjunct my sun. Look at that.
But yeah, so yeah, exactly. You see, yeah, look at that. Yeah, so look at that. Exactly. So, I guess the thing is, I don't know. I hope I'm not wounding you today.
I hope I'm not wounding you.
Well, you are. I feel. I actually am feeling. Well, you did at the beginning, being half, 20 minutes late.
Because I got the time wrong. Did you feel wounded?
No, I didn't feel wounded. No, I'm teasing. Teasing. What the Chiron did talk to me about was a sense of one's marginality, one sense of not being in a system, one sense of being on the margins of a system, which I always felt, you know, and I celebrate and I give thanks to actually Chiron in my life. Even though it's been difficult, I have been on the margins. That meant I didn't have to be at the center of the system. I couldn't imagine myself being in the center of systems today, you know? And so my life was graced by, I think, feeling marginal. And yet the irony, of course, is that once you feel that way, you don't necessarily, it doesn't necessarily happen to you. It's just part of who you are. When Chiron was discovered, one of the first keywords that was given was maverick.
Mm.
And when I looked it up in the dictionary, maverick, it was named after a man called Samuel Maverick. And he didn't brand his cattle. And so he was the only cattle rancher who didn't brand his cattle. And that's where the word maverick comes from. And that was one of the first keywords for Chiron. I think I understand this, you know. Being maverick is not being branded like everyone else, like, oh, follow the herd, do the thing. And I was never one to follow the herd. I love being part of groups. There's no doubt about that, but I don't like to follow the herd.
Mm-hmm.
And so I think as astrologers, many astrologers would really relate to the idea of Chiron.
Yeah.
But it also has that sense of appreciation about the ancestral, I think ancestral inheritances that we have. And so it's a very rich and deep. And also, it also spoke to me about the symbols in our symptoms. So it gave me a new richness about understanding people's illness. And I can never understand when people tell me that they have this, what it means. I say, please tell me the symptoms. And in the symptoms, I hear the images. And then when I hear the images, I can see them in the horoscope.
Isn't that interesting? And yours is in the sixth house, which is health. And yeah, that makes so much sense.
Yeah, that's exactly right. Yeah. So I was able, like, symptomology became very important for me. So the and then when I had rheumatoid arthritis myself, and I for about 3 years, and I couldn't even get out of bed, I couldn't even lift the doona off me. I didn't feel like there was something wrong with me. There was a kind of a sense of being with this image, being with this symptom, being with this time, that you know, it wasn't, you know, I couldn't say I appreciated it. I didn't appreciate being ill, but I honored it, I guess.
Mm.
And that was thanks to Chiron, thanks to the understanding of that it's just not about healing. It's about wounding and healing. It's about a cycle of wounding and healing.
So do you think, because I think it's interesting, the synchronicity, even, you know, astrosynthesis, your school was at the Chiron Center. You had Melanie Reinhardt, the, you know, Chiron Queen, that really helped open up this archetype and bring it through as well, teaching there. And, you know, I'm just thinking, God, it's such an imprint on my personal chart. I found you guys. That's all synchronicity, isn't it? And here you are still talking about it. So I feel like I'm, because you guys brought it through so strongly, that's just part of my astrological lineage, of course, through you. And I feel like I understand it quite well as well. Thankfully, it explains a lot. And then I get those people coming to me so I can help them out. But I don't feel like Chiron, you know, the archetype Chiron was a wounded healer that could never heal itself. And I think people think it's about the wound healing, and I don't think it necessarily does. It's like you were saying before, there's an acceptance, and that's really what you want to aim for, and a recognition, like, so that it's conscious. That's really where you want to get to. And then just that's it. And then you can heal, sort of, you heal by healing other people. Like, I totally get that. Like, I say it's like AA when you sponsor someone else. It's like this reciprocal thing. And when I was writing my first book, that's what came to me, and I looked up how that all worked. And they were saying helping someone else actually worked for the person that's helping them much more. And that was, to me, that's very Chironic, that experience.
Very Chironic. Very Chironic. So it'd be a wonderful lesson that we could learn in our culture. That politicians could learn that lesson, I would think. We won't go there. But it spoke to me. And of course, Melanie has always been such a wonderful colleague.
Because, yes.
You know, we've shared the Chiron. We were born the same year. You know, we have the same Chirons. and so it was an important archetype. And I really do appreciate, Vanessa, you saying what you said about that, because part of putting Chiron into the syllabus of an astrological program is bringing another archetype forward. And and the archetype that not only taught healing, you know, he taught the disenfranchised young men and young women how the skills of life.
Mm. Yeah. And how to like go for glory regardless.
Yeah, absolutely. Regardless of your wounds. Yeah.
Yeah, exactly.
Regardless of your Achilles heels or your, yeah.
Yeah, exactly. Very interesting. I find that very interesting. So we're up to an hour now. I shall ask you a couple more questions and then I shall let you go. Wanted to know, what do you think is the shadow side of Libra? You know, we've all got shade. What's the Libran shade? You know, you were saying before there's some little claws under there.
Well, probably the illusion that they think they don't have a shadow. It's someone else. Oh, you know. The shadow of Libra has to do with the kind of difficulty in expressing the truth, I think, the emotional truth, the difficulty in being able to hold negative feeling long enough to really let it process. So the claws of the scorpion are very much there, you know. And I do think the shadow of Libra is that it can be sometimes, because it doesn't process the negative feelings or the dark feelings, can sometimes be fairly rude or aggressive or without unconsciously, yeah. Because it's coming through, you know, trying to, it's coming through. So there is a kind of a sense of Libra's, I think, so very focused on that sense of what's light and polite and socially acceptable. It's what's not acceptable in them that oftentimes bleeds through in their social context.
So you think that Libra, you know, that sounds like that idea of projection. Do you think Libra really has, it's the most, one of the most beneficial things or advice for Libra is to understand that concept of projection and learn to become,
I think, for all air signs, because but very much for Libra, yes, you're right. Like Libra, the lesson is the mirror is in front of you. You know, the mirror is in front of you, and try to see the projection that's coming back to them.
So do you think, like, knowing about astrology, like through astrology, about that, all the sides of Libra, has that helped you to become more conscious of different facets of yourself that's very Libran in nature?
Yeah, very much so. Yeah, I can remember, you know, when I was a very young man, and I was taking a workshop, an actor's workshop, and you get up on stage and you say, well, what do you want your journey of life to be? And I sort of spieled off this Neptune, and Neptune's in Libra journey, you know, it's going to be wonderful, it'll be life. And the director said, I don't give a F about what you think you're, you know, it's what a bunch of S-H-I-T you're telling me. They really gave it to me. I was devastated. I thought to myself, I'm just being this really nice guy and just really being, you know, open and wonderful and charming. And somebody didn't appreciate this. I was crushed. And then it sort of sunk into me, like he taught me the biggest lesson of the fact that, you know, like, not everybody's going to accept this is the way life is. You know, there's a lot of stuff that we don't want to see. And there's a lot of life isn't about fair. So being liberal, you think I'm going to be fair. Everyone's going to be fair to me. Doesn't work that way. And being liberal, you think, well, I'm going to be socially polite and everyone else will be. No, doesn't work that way. So that's, astrology sort of taught me that. I look at everything in astrology, as long as we apply consciousness to it, it's a great teacher.
Yeah.
Consciousness is the key to any astrology we learn.
Yeah. It definitely helps. Yeah, I see astrology. It's like a framework that you can jump off from. So you can use your intuition with it. It brings things to consciousness because you've got that solid framework to start with. You get to have both your cake and to eat it with astrology, I think. Well, start to wrap it up there. Is there anything else that you would like to share about the Libran vibe? Like, I don't know what not to do around a Libra.
Well, aging, you know, aging's not always difficult for Libra because, you know, they like, they do like to dress, they like to have nice clothes and dress, I think. And so I'd say to the aging Libras, like, well, just be graceful, just be graceful. There's an inner beauty about every human being that and if you try to keep covering up all your life, that's never going to get there. What else would I like to share about Libra? Just love a Libra. Just love a Libra.
Give a Libra love.
And be kind to Libras.
Oh, I know. I've got one thing. Neptune in Libra generation. Yeah. Can you sort of sum up that? Like, I know the Neptune in Sag, what was happening at the time with, you know, people going to India and all that sort of thing and disco. Yeah. But what about the Neptune in Libra? How did that express?
Well, the Neptune in Libra, you know, it's interesting you mentioned that because that came to mind right at the beginning because it was such a generation, isn't it? Neptune in Libra talk about romance and idealism and, you know, everything is perfect and wonderful. And as we grew up with that myth, you know, everything's perfect and wonderful. Meanwhile, there's always other stuff going on. We found out the Pluto and Virgo generation found that out for us, that there's all this stuff going on when we thought everything was wonderful. You know, Pluto, Neptune and Libra, you know, the church was wonderful, father knows best, all this. Meanwhile, there's all this stuff going on. But what of course happened to our Neptune in Libra generation was that Pluto came along. And of course, because Pluto and Neptune are sextile for, you know, those 100 years, everybody in their 20s gets Pluto conjunct to Neptune at some point. And, you know, and then their generation. So for my generation was the ideals were shattered, you know, the ideals of perfectness and love and romance and idealism were seen in a different way.
You know? So the illusion was...
The illusion was shattered.
Interesting. Yeah. So do you think each Neptune generation gets some sort of...
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
Yeah.
Oh, absolutely. Ooh. Their 20s with Pluto. Yeah. It's like, I like calling it the quarter life crisis, you know, around that Pluto Neptune. It shatters the illusion that we've held up of that particular, myth, I guess. The myth of love. Yeah.
That's hilarious. I've been saying quarter life crisis for the kids having a quarter life crisis. I'm like, it's okay, you're having a quarter life crisis. But I wasn't thinking about why that would be with the Neptune. So that's interesting as well.
The 20s do supply us with a lot of quarter life crises. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah. Wouldn't want to do it again. No, thanks.
No, just bring the body back. That's all.
Well, they're working on that in science. I don't know. You just got to, Chiron, just go with it. Accept it. You've had your day. Let them have their day.
Thanks for reminding me of that. Thanks for reminding me. Thank you.
Yeah, it's okay to, Well, thank you so much for sharing the Libra love. What I wanted to also honour, you know, your legacy and Glynis, and with having you on and sharing your work as well and sharing you with my audience. You've got so many books that are available on your site at astrosynthesis.com.au. You have the whole downloadable course, all in audio with the digital booklets as well. Very good value for anyone that would like to hear Brian wax lyrical with incredible amount of wisdom and experience, years and years worth of teaching, excellent teacher. What else would you like people to do? Do you have anything coming up, or where would you like people to go?
Well, on our website, we also have student resources. So you can look there and I put, if I'm making, you know, notes for a seminar, I put them up, or there's some webinars there. So there's a lot of student resources you can just download yourself. What's coming up? I'm Faculty of Astrological Studies in January. I'm doing about three webinars on family. So that's the Faculty of Astrological Studies. And for the London School of Astrology, I'm doing some videos for them and also work for their Chinese program as well. And yeah, what else is coming up? So I do things for the Jung Society once a year as well. So just keep, you can join our newsletter.
Join the newsletter. Yep. Okay. And you do, you've been doing a few things at Astrology University as well.
Astrology University. Absolutely. Yeah. I just I just finished a course on relationships with University of Australia.
Oh, there you go. Go back and check them out.
Yeah, University of Astrology. I do have, it was a 5-week course we did on relationships. Yeah.
Five weeks.
That was great. So, yeah.
Go to absolutely. The source, guys.
Oh, you're very, very kind. And thank you for mentioning the book. Like, but I don't know if I really answer your question, but the answer about the tone from the moment we met, as far as relationships, that book is fairly complete book.
Yes, so you feel like you've got everything in there. It looks very complete to me. I was just wondering, if you felt like that was complete, is it possible to even get to that point? So that's interesting to hear.
It was, and one of the things, I better let you go, but one of the things, a comment on Amazon said that the book, I was too verbose. There was a lot of good wisdom in it, but he could have said that in 200 pages. And it was very verbose. I just laughed because I thought, sometimes I am too verbose.
And you can't please all the people all the time. You know, it's going back to what you were saying earlier about Libra wanting to, you know, I guess it's that thinking everyone can get along, you know, Taylor Swift sings that haters gonna hate. Like, that's, she nailed it with that. And that's definitely a good advice for anyone with that Libra, isn't it? You can't please all the people all the time. So just channel yourself and people
your
that
creativity.
Like it. Like it.
Yeah, do your creativity, and that's what you need to do.
Hey, Starling, I'm reading you a few excerpts. We're going to do Venus, the cusp of the seventh house, and the intro to planets in the seventh house from Brian's book, From the Moment We Met, The Astrology of Adult Relationships. Venus. In our examination of adult relationship, Venus is paramount as the archetype suggests the urge for love, union, connection, and relationship. While the moon is also the bonding instinct, it is representative of dependent and familial attachments, whereas Venus suggests more independent and equal relationships, often forged outside the family's comfort zone. It denotes our personal values, tastes, likes and dislikes, as well as what we find pleasurable and beautiful. Therefore, underlying our passions, attractions, and connections are our personal tastes, pleasures, and values. While Venus is about the urge for a loving relationship, it also signifies the experience of self-love and self-worth. Venus embodies the power to attract. Venus is this magnetic quality which renders her irresistible. While fashion, style, adornment, and taste go through collective trends, Venus is personal. One's tastes, pleasures, and passions are highly subjective, for what one finds beautiful and alluring, another may not. Venus is the core of our own individual ideals and esteem. Not only lovers fall under the goddess's spell, artists, singers, fashion and entertainment personnel, curators of museums and managers of bars, those enjoying festivities, gaming and other pleasures are also entranced by Venus. In other words, the inhabitants of Venus's domain are drawn to beauty, creativity, art, sensuality and pleasure. But it is also in her domain where love, sexuality and relationship are located. However, this domain is often fraught with other features of love and relationships such as vanity, passion, jealousy, and triangles. The nature of Venus in each horoscope will reveal personal tastes but will also reflect our attitude towards love and relationships, whether sexually intimate, emotionally close, or friendly companionship. It's how we warmly respond to the other and the soulful quality that attracts us to someone else. Venus is our mode of expressing affection and the way in which we in turn receive it. Ultimately, it is the qualities we hold dear in ourselves and how we resonate to those qualities in others. Venus is the anima who connects us to the heart of adult relationship, as well as the muse who draws us to the beauty in the world, not only in others, but especially in ourselves. Through this chapter, there's an intro to More planets, but I'm going to skip through right through to chapter 7, Through the Looking Glass, delineating the descendant. So the seventh house is the house of the other. No matter how we conceptualize our life partner, whether it is the significant other, a committed companion, the soulmate or spouse, their image hovers over the threshold of our descendant. Our other half is an image embedded in the horizon since birth. As the sign opposite your ascendant, it complements your personality, like another half of the self available as you step through the looking glass into the shape-shifting world of relationship. This other half is often more recognizable in others than in yourself. Sometimes you want to embrace it, sometimes reject it. Certainly the qualities that you find both appealing and annoying are symbolized by this reflection. The sign on the seventh house cusp is often prominent in your partner's horoscope, but whether you marry or divorce, your seventh house is essentially always a part of who you are. For example, in Brad Pitt's horoscope, Gemini is on the cusp of the seventh house, which is Angelina's sun sign. Angelina has Capricorn descending, and Brad has four planets, including the Moon and Venus in Capricorn. Angelina's sun is conjunct Brad's descendant, while Brad's moon is conjunct Angelina's descendant. In the horoscopes of Whitney and Bobby, similar interchanges occur. Whitney's seventh house cusp is Virgo, and Bobby has the moon in Virgo. Bobby has Cancer on the descendant, and Cancer is a sign of Whitney's north node. In the seventh, we enter into the mystery of relating. What we are attracted to appears to be opposite and different, yet it is also the partial reflection of what is not yet conscious in us. The seventh house is an amalgam of what is seen and what is in shadow. We sense kinship, congeniality, and familiarity with our seventh house partners, yet these feelings do not arise from a conscious memory. Our partners are our companions, kindred spirits, and intimate others. Human nature inclines towards styling our partners from the clay of our own unresolved patterns and complexes. The materials we use for this are our own projections, fantasies, and ideals, as well as earlier patterns of relationship that we've internalized from our parents and siblings. The seventh house is an area of equality. Therefore, our partners will share in our characteristics and qualities. Not only a house of union, the seventh house is also one of separateness and individuality. Rainer Maria Rilke, who wrote eloquently of love and relationship, could have been referring to the seventh house when he wrote, "Two solitudes protect and border and greet each other." In this place, a partnership is created between separate individuals who are equals. So that chapter goes on to delineate each sign on the cusp of the seventh and, of course, in relation to the rising sign. So next I'm going to jump through to chapter 8, Encountering Other Planets in the Seventh House. I'm going to read you the intro from this one. Your seventh house planets were setting or preparing to set when you were born. Their transition between the visible or objective day world and the unseen subjective night world was underway. Being between worlds, these planets are liminal, refocusing their vision and intention, becoming sensitized to a different mode of being. Metaphorically, this is a twilight phase. These planets are more receptive to the shadows cast by the fading light, the shifting colors, and the intense otherness of their experience. The ancients recognized that when we are in a liminal space, we are on a crossway between two ways of being. On a threshold, there is a likelihood that a divinity might appear. Therefore, in transition, we are more likely to be alert and receptive to the signs and symbols that mark our way. As the atmosphere of the seventh house is transitional, any planet in this territory is watchful and sensitive to the divine crossing its path. When someone who embodies the planetary archetype is on the horizon, there is a reaction, sometimes an attraction, perhaps a revulsion, but nonetheless a response from our inner self. Something is awoken in us by the stranger in the shadows of the place. Like an epiphany, when the outer image reflects the inner situation, a sudden recognition of something occurs. The divine in us stirs. The seventh house contains both the poetry of enchantment and the lament of disappointment with others who walk on the path of our life. They stir the unawakened gods in us. Astrologically, these are personified by the planets in the seventh house setting place. Imagine setting a place at the table for an unknown visitor. Who would it be? Planets in the seventh house are prone to being projected onto the partner or an equal other, which can inhibit the contact with them in ourselves. Since the horoscope symbolizes qualities in ourself, not others, it's wise to try to honor our seventh house planetary energies in ourselves as well. When left projected, they tend to empower and inflate others at our own expense. When equilibrium between the inner and outer situation does not exist, a power struggle between ownership can become apparent. Planets in the seventh house that are utilized by their owner are powerful and effective because they're on the horizon, opposing us and challenging our identity. This horizon represents the quest for selfhood through relationship and engages us in the polarity of self and other. So always a fascinating house, the seventh house, as they all are, but in its own special way. I like to refer to it as a bit of a hall of mirrors, especially with transits. I'm going to read one section of this. The rest of this chapter goes through each planet in the seventh house, the delineation of each one. So I'm going to read the sun and see if I relate to it, because I have sun as well as a few other planets in the seventh house. You were born as dusk approached, so the sun was lowering on the western horizon. Metaphorically, this suggests that your personal identity is reflective, aware of the interplay of shadow and light, and prone to identify with others, seeing your reflection in their light. By nature, the sun is bright and shining, but here it is preparing to withdraw its light. The sunlight is still warming and illuminating, but now it's on an internal and creative level. The sun in the seventh responds to the magnetism, creativity, and charisma in others, attracted to the self-assured personality you might like to be. While drawn to the star quality in others, yes, I have to say I did call my first book Star Power for a reason, you know, referencing Dear Reader. So while drawn to the star quality in others, you may also feel eclipsed by their shadow. When your own identity and confidence are being eclipsed, you tend to see your partner as more creative, more vital, and certainly more self-assured than you. Unconsciously, you may empower your partner with the qualities of strength, heroism, and great accomplishments, leaving your own sense of self weakened, uncertain, and insecure. When you relinquish your solar right to shine, you may become disenchanted with your partner until you reclaim some of your own charm and appeal. Resentment and blame accumulate when your partners live out what has not yet become conscious in yourself. Once the shadow of self-absorption and narcissism appears, the necessity to regain your own creativity and confidence becomes apparent. At best, you learn to share the stage equally, stressing your right to be recognized and appreciated. The sun in the seventh finds creativity and identity through the process of relating. Since the sun is also the archetype of the father, this placement also suggests that questions about father may enter the sphere of relationship. The partner may constellate your incomplete father issues, especially issues of favoritism and the need to be seen and acknowledged. When you find the balance between acknowledging and supporting your identity with the creative pursuits of your partner, your relationship is centered on the support of each partner's creative projects. And then the chapter goes through each planet in the seventh house. Do you have any planets in the seventh house? Not everyone does. However, you have a sign on the cusp and you look to the ruling planet of that sign to open up the delineation of your seventh house all the more. Also, do you have any planets in Libra? So I definitely relate to some of that about the sun in the seventh for sure. And it's the sorts of things I wish I understood more when I was much younger. I understand them now, and astrology, well, psychological astrology has really helped with that. I think I'm way ahead on my journey because of astrology. So highly recommended this book. It has synastry sections and just lots and lots of bits and pieces, beautifully written with a lot of insight. So check that out, From the Moment We Met, The Astrology of Adult Relationships by Brian Clark. All right, so have a great day, evening, whatever you're doing today, and stay cosmic. Thank you for joining me today. This has been Vanessa Montgomery. For more astro and modern mysticism, find me at astroallstars.com. Remember, that's stars with a Z. Take care and stay cosmic.